Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday. Wednesday, the 28th of January. And this hour we talk about Abraham Lincoln and a wonderful new book. There are many this year, but this is a gorgeous pictorial history and discussion of Lincoln from the day of his assassination to the monument that was very much on our television screens during the inauguration of Barack Obama, the construction of and the ideas behind the planning of the Lincoln Memorial in 1922. Our guest is Philip Kuhnhart, and his book that he has put together with family members is Looking for Lincoln, The Making of an American Icon. Actually, five successive generations of his family have helped chronicle the photographs and research that went into this book. The Lincoln connection began with an ancestor who fought in the Civil War, was wounded at Antietam, and met the 16th president twice. And then there have been subsequent books and collections of Lincoln photographs, and all the people in, you know, the family have been working, not all the people, but a number of the people in the family have been working for all these generations. We're going to concentrate, I think, this hour because there's so much here about the significance, as the authors write. Two things became especially clear as they looked at putting together this book. One was the role played by African Americans in the safeguarding of Lincoln's legacy, insisting that Lincoln be remembered for his crucial role in emancipation and not only as savior of the Union. And the second, the significance of Robert Lincoln to his father's story, the only character to span the entire book, a complicated person, complicated relationship with his father. There are a lot of stories about him and how his memory was preserved through Robert. So we're going to have a good hour. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that as well, and that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Philip. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's great to be with you, Kathleen. Thank you for having me.
Oh, yeah, our pleasure. Why don't you start with your family? I just think it's a remarkable story that all these generations have worked on Lincoln. Don't you?
It is. It's hard to escape when you grow up in this family. You mentioned my great-great-grandfather, William Neal Meserve, who fought in the Civil War. It was really his son that got us going in a big time. His father asked my great-grandfather, Frederick Hill Meserve, to find illustrations for his Civil War memoirs that he had written. And my great-grandfather, who I knew, he began to scour the countryside for these images that, you know, nobody was really collecting them at that point. And so he caught the bug, the collecting bug, and he eventually became known as the preeminent expert on 19th century portraiture, and in particular on the study of Abraham Lincoln, the face of Abraham Lincoln.
Mm-hmm. And some of the pictures, I read this somewhere, were about to be thrown out, weren't they? And he found them?
He did. I think he's responsible for having saved a number of things. His big discovery, which occurred in 1902, was he sort of detective-like tracked down a whole mass of glass negatives that had been come out of the camera of Matthew Brady, mm-hmm. the New York photographer, who was really the preeminent portrait photographer during the 19th century. But he had gone bankrupt late in his life and had been lost all of his photographs. These had been paid in lieu of debt to his printer. And my great-grandfather discovered that the printer, the company that had succeeded his printer, still had possession of this glass, and he found them in a warehouse in Hoboken, New Jersey, and they were kind of almost discarded. They were lying in piles, some of them broken. They were kind of dusty, and no one was paying any attention to them. And he went over and looked at them, and one of the images he held up, he saw was the image of Abraham Lincoln, and he suddenly realized there was a vast treasure here.
Oh, yes. And was that
he bought the entire lot and spent really the rest of his long life becoming the renowned expert on these images.
What a story. And was that the picture that Abraham Lincoln, it's in the book, credits for his victory in 1860?
No, that one was not one of the negatives he acquired. The actual picture of Abraham Lincoln that he held up that day was the famous profile taken in 1864, which later was used to model the image on our Lincoln penny.
Oh. Huh.
But the one you refer to is a very, very important picture, also taken by Matthew Brady in 1860 when Lincoln was campaigning, and that image was used to make woodblock prints and was run in newspapers all across the country and got Lincoln's face known in households. And he attributed a lot of help to it in terms of his election.
One of his better pictures, and you do write in the book about Lincoln being photographed. He was photographed quite often, wasn't he?
He was. For those times, it was unprecedented. I mean, there had been earlier presidents who had been photographed. Going back, I believe the first president to be photographed was James K. Polk, who there's some interesting daguerreotype images of him in the White House, actually, in the East Room, posing with his cabinet members. And then some of the even earlier presidents were photographed in old age, in retirement. Actually, Matthew Brady got an image of Andrew Jackson before he died, which is a very, very extraordinary image, as well as John Quincy Adams. But nobody had really, no president before Lincoln had been heavily photographed or had used photography as a way to further their political goals. Lincoln was the first to do this, and he was photographed more than 100 times on different occasions. He rarely turned down an opportunity to sit for an image. And thus we have an extraordinary record of his evolving face.
You sure do. One of the more dramatic pictures, there are many of them in the book, I was showing this to office mates yesterday, is, and when you think about what was about to happen, this picture in Charleston, South Carolina, just hours before Lincoln's assassination, this flag-raising ceremony at Fort Sumter. What destruction in that city. And then there are several African-American young children who are sitting right in the middle of the picture. It's a knockout picture, I think.
I actually have been going around showing some slides based on my book, and that's the one I use first.
Do you?
Because it's taken on the very day of Lincoln's assassination, April 14th, 1865. It was taken in the morning. Lincoln was still alive. He wasn't there. He was in Washington. But a lot of dignitaries had gone down to Fort Sumter where the war had begun. And this was a triumphant moment. They were raising the Union flag back over that fort for the first time and really declaring that the war was over.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a celebratory occasion. And then, as you say, the photographers went out into the city of Charleston, which had been destroyed badly. And there was nobody there, except they saw this little group of black kids sitting amongst the rubble. And that's a kind of haunting image from that very day. And that same night, Lincoln goes out to Ford's Theater with his wife and friends and is murdered.
Yeah. And you tell me about the time span of the book, Philip. Why did you go from the day of the assassination to 1922?
Well, you know, originally I wanted to go all the way up to the present, believe it or not. I thought I thought the book would be cool to take it right up until today. Of course, I didn't know, you know, what today would hold or how amazingly relevant our times would be to the Lincoln story.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I was working on this book, we did not yet have the candidacy of Barack Obama or his extraordinary invocation of Lincoln's memory. And yet that developed during the writing process.
Mm-hmm.
But I found that, there was a special richness to that early period, the first 60 years after the death, in which all the people that had known him most closely were still alive and could share their memories of him. And so I call them we who knew him. And it's a very potent period in terms of the laying down of Lincoln's memories. Any biographer since has had to go back to those reminiscences, those books, those speeches, that period of time in which to find the primary, you know, building blocks for understanding Lincoln's life.
Right. Tell me, because the book starts with this, and you include pictures of this and clippings from newspapers on that day and the subsequent days, the word of his assassination, how it moved through this country, and how it was treated in different parts of the country quite differently.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, today we think of Lincoln, I mean, he's such a lionized figure, such a revered figure by most people, that we forget that at the time he was assassinated, he was despised by most people in the South, as you might expect. I mean, he was the head of the country that was at war with them. They saw themselves as a separate country at this point. And they had suffered terribly during that war, and there had been great destruction, especially in the final years as Sherman moved through and burned. Those pictures in Charleston are kind of emblematic of that destruction. And so he was, you know, when the news went into the South, there was rejoicing.
Mm-hmm.
John Wilkes Booth was considered a hero in many places. Now, that's not universally so. I mean, obviously, there were many Southerners who were shocked by the news, including Robert E. Lee himself, who thought it was a sorry day in American history. But there were others that just were so consumed by the pain of the war that they thought that Booth had killed a tyrant, an evil oppressor, and that this was a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, that's absolutely the mirror opposite of the reaction throughout the North. Lincoln hadn't been adored by everyone in the North. I mean, remember, he was a minority elected president. He only had 39% of the popular vote. He had a whole party, the Democratic Party, almost defeated him in the 64 election. He was very unpopular during a good part of his presidency. But, you know, the assassination changed that. And even his political enemies in the North pretty much came round and came to they participated in the general grief that right. swept through all the northern states and all the way out west.
And you
so
have...
there were very different reactions. There were also different reactions between white people and black people. And black people were probably the most vocal of the mourners, as was pointed out. They gathered around the White House, wailing and weeping and. There was a sense that the emancipated, their father Abraham, had been stricken down, and it was, you know. So you can go around. What we do is we look at the different regions of the country, we look at different political parties, we look at different groups, and they each did have a somewhat different reaction to the news of the murder.
Let's talk a little bit more. You make this clear in the intro to your book, and I want to make sure that we spend time on these two things that became clear to you, you say, during your research. One, the role played by African Americans in the safeguarding of his legacy, insisting that Lincoln be remembered for his crucial role in emancipation and not only as a savior of the Union. How was that accomplished? Why was that important to African Americans, and how was that accomplished?
Well, it's a complicated story, and it only became clear, you know, deep into the work. But it really has to do with, obviously for African Americans, the Emancipation Proclamation and then the destruction of slavery that occurred through the war effort and through the 13th Amendment, which Lincoln was very involved with, meant that Lincoln would be remembered chiefly as the great emancipator. And there was very early on, there was a great celebration of him as such. In the first years after his death, he was widely remembered by blacks and whites as the great emancipator. But what happens is, over the next decades, there is a gradual attrition within the North of interest in this field. And if you can see it through the kind of statues that are built. The early ones do emphasize the emancipator role. The later ones kind of drop that theme and begin to just portray him more as the statesman. The problem is that the country, this rift between North and South, becomes more and more of a problem, and the need to heal that breach becomes a higher and higher priority in American history. And in order to do that, the race issue has to be put on the back burner. And this becomes very clear when you get up until the turn of the century, and you get especially into things like the centennial celebrations in 1909, and you get into the dedication of the Lincoln Memorial itself in Washington in 1926, or 1922 rather, you see that the theme of emancipation has been completely eliminated. There's no discussion of it at all. And it's entirely a North-South reconciliation event. You have members in uniform from the Confederate and Union armies. The old veterans are there shaking hands. You have speeches about the reunited country, that everybody loves Lincoln now, that he's a symbol of our unity. And you have, you know, by this point, blacks have been shunted off to the side. They're totally segregated events. It's interesting that there's a loss of interest in Lincoln as emancipator, except for within the African-American community. It's people like Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist who went on to become a public servant, who tries to keep this legacy alive through his writings, through his speeches, and then others as well. Booker T. Washington, W.B. Du Bois, African-American newspapers and magazines. This is where the emancipationist legacy lives on, even when the white America wants to suppress it or forget it.
And how much of that is due to how, well, Reconstruction was so bungled, but to the to Andrew Johnson, who first, you know, was going to carry on with Reconstruction and looking at these issues, and then does a complete, as you say, about face on this issue.
Well, he was. There was great hopefulness when he assumed the presidency. A lot of the even more radical members of the Congress thought he might be even better than Lincoln on the Reconstruction issues and the race issues in particular. But you know, he was from Tennessee. He had been a strong Unionist, which is why he was chosen to be vice president. But he had no love of the black race. He was a truly prejudiced man. And most were in those days, but he was vastly more racist than Lincoln. Lincoln himself was struggling with these issues, but Johnson had no love for the black race, and that quickly came out, and he became a despised figure among the congressmen and across the country, really.
Mm-hmm. If only things had been different, right? I know we can't, but you look at what was a setback. And a significant setback after the life of this extraordinary president.
Well, Frederick Douglass himself said that, you know, had Lincoln lived, we might have seen a far more progressive unfolding of events.
Mm-hmm.
Lincoln himself was changing. He was growing. He was learning. He had become deeply, you know, he did have racial prejudice himself, especially back in the earlier days of his life. And you could see this pop up again and again during the Senate campaigns in 1858, when his opponent, Stephen A. Douglas, would accuse him of being in favor of black-white marriage, or would be in favor of full equality for blacks, or having them be elected to a public office. And these were highly unpopular positions. And Lincoln would go out of his way to deny that he ever felt this way. And he would say some things that we wish he had never said, but that he did say.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, during the years of his presidency, he still could occasionally show this side of himself. But I think he grew a light years, and I think the major reason one of the major factors was when his own Emancipation Proclamation allowed for the enlistment of African Americans into the Union Army, and they went on to fight in battles and in various places during the war. He saw a level of courage and bravery from these men that changed him.
Yeah.
And he came to feel that anyone who would put their lives on the line for their country, for this country, deserved, you know, to be fully a part of it.
Right.
So he was moving in those kind of directions when he was murdered.
Did he say about this, or did I read, is this in your book, I get all my Lincoln. I love Lincoln, so I've read a lot about Lincoln. But did he say when he was in the depths of very severe depression and maybe even suicidal earlier in his life, and he talked to a friend about wanting to do a great thing, you know, what's the purpose of living if I can't do something that will be remembered? And did he think of the Emancipation Proclamation and say that that was the great thing when he signed it?
Yes, he did.
He did.
He did. And you know who points this out very clearly, and maybe you talked with her, is Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Ah.
She, in her marvelous book, Team of Rivals, she makes a big deal out of this. But I do, too. This was something he said to his closest personal friend of his young years, Joshua Speed.
Yes.
And he told Speed in the depths of that depression, which occurred at the time of his breakup with his fiancée, Mary Todd, that he felt that he would kill himself, except that he had not done anything that would make anybody ever remember anyone remember that he had ever lived. Mm-hmm. And that's what, in a way, got him back on track, was an ambition to make a difference in the world, to do something lasting, and thereby gain a kind of immortality, which was beyond anything he believed in personally,
yes.
In a religious sense. And later, it was when Joshua Speed, the same man, visited him in the White House late in his presidency, he told him that now he felt he could relax and rest because he had done that great thing that he had always wanted to do.
Did he ever, right? Little did he know how much he would be remembered in this 200th year of his birth. We're going to welcome phone calls. If you'd like to join the conversation, please join us. Our guest is Philip Kuhnhart, and he and other people in his family are the author of a number of books on Lincoln, the latest one just released, and it will be the focus of a PBS special on Lincoln that's taking place in February during the 200th year of his celebration of his birth. Looking for Lincoln is the title of the book, with an introduction by Doris Kearns Goodwin, and it has just been published by Knopf, and the pictures are just extraordinary, and all the reminiscences of people who knew him and how the press treated him, and stories of the assassination and John Wilkes Booth and the trial. It's just, well, I love Lincoln, as you know, but it's the pictures are great, and as is the commentary. So join us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Philip Kuhnhart is our guest. The book is Looking for Lincoln, The Making of an American Icon. Gorgeous pictures, extracts from newspapers, letters, books, and documents of many kinds to help trace the making of Lincoln's story. The book concentrates on the years from 1865, the assassination, to 1922, the dedication of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. So we have phone lines open. You were saying that, Philip, that you didn't know as you were writing this how American history was going to unfold. And look at what happened. You know, I must say, I love the inauguration, but that celebration at the Lincoln Memorial, which I've kept on tape and probably will keep it for a long period of time, was just, to you as a Lincoln historian, the whole thing must be very profound on many levels.
It is. I feel a very strong arc connecting the age of Lincoln with our own times. And in some ways, this is a great fulfillment, not only of the things that Lincoln worked for, but the things that others were working for. Frederick Douglass, this would have been a great fulfillment of his dream. I mean, and the fact that President Obama has, throughout the campaign, has invoked Lincoln and admires him so as a kind of hero of his own, I found very moving. You remember when he, in Grant Park, at the night of his victory in the election night, he quoted from Lincoln's first inaugural address. Mm-hmm. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. This whole idea of trying to unite the country, I found it profoundly moving.
Yes, it is. Let's go to Alice from Sheboygan, our first caller. Hi, Alice.
Hello.
Hi, Alice.
I was calling. I had a question. First of all, my great-grandfather, I had older parents. My great-grandfather fought in the Civil War, and I've always been interested in it. So I met an old, old psychiatrist who was a historian also, who told me about the Wisconsin connection, where one of our governors headed out with his wife to take medicine to the Wisconsin soldiers, but drowned along the way. His wife continued on and appealed to Lincoln, and she to let her bring these soldiers back to Wisconsin. And after meeting with him several times, he allowed her to bring them back on trains. And that this group of soldiers had a higher survival rate than the other soldiers because they were taken out of these war hospitals.
Hmm. Are you familiar with that story, Phil?
I'm not familiar with the story. I'm fascinated by it, though. Right. And there's so many interesting local stories about Lincoln and his effect on people, especially during the war. He did take a particular interest in the wounded soldiers, and often, you know, gave special, you know, privileges and rights of transit. So this is very interesting to me.
Okay, I thought Kathleen would like it.
Yes, yes. Thank you, Alice. You may want to send us a note on it too. We'll get it to Philip.
Okay,
because he's not done with Lincoln by a long shot. Thanks for your call. There was another.
You could spend a lifetime and still not have gotten very, you know, scratch the surface, if you will. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, there is
how many
so much.
Scholars have spent their lives studying Lincoln and still find it a rich area of study.
Right. And there was another Wisconsin governor who brought news to Andrew Johnson about the assassination of Lincoln, wasn't there? I didn't know that story.
That's interesting. How, you know, Johnson was asleep in his boarding. You know, you remember that. You know, in those days there was no vice presidential residence. He was staying in a hotel, and the former governor of Wisconsin was a friend of his and ran over to see him and woke him up and gave him the news. Mm-hmm. That was Leonard Farwell. Mm-hmm. And he had been serving in Washington as a Lincoln appointee, but he was a particularly friend with the vice president, and it was he who gave him the horrid news that mm-hmm. changed his life.
Sure did. Thanks, Alice, for the call. Let's go to Greg next from Racine. Hi, Greg.
Hi there. This is a fantastic book. I absolutely love it, start to finish. I wanted the author to talk about the interesting photograph that's on the cover of the book, and I also think listeners would enjoy hearing one of the stories almost kind of told in passing about how easy it was for public to meet Lincoln in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
That's recounted in one of the stories, and it's, of course, so utterly different from today.
Right.
I was wondering if Mr. Kunhart knew if that was typical of presidents of the 19th century or if President Lincoln had an exceptionally open sort of policy in terms of meeting the public.
Yeah, great questions. Thanks.
No, that is a great question, and I'll take it first, you know, that second half of your question, because and thank you for what you said about the book. It's obviously you've read it closely, because that is one of the kind of obscure pieces of information that's tucked away in here that you would have had to, you know, read closely to find. Lincoln did have we were worlds away from the world of Lincoln. It's amazing to me that the access the average person had to our president in those days. Anybody in those days could just walk over to the White House, knock on the door, be greeted by a doorman and given a card, and then go upstairs and take a seat in a waiting room and just wait their turn. And then finally they'd be called in, and they could have a few minutes with the president. And he, you know, his advisors begged him to stop doing this. They said it's putting you in danger. It is also wasting your time. You know, you have more important things to do. And Lincoln was insisted on keeping this open door policy. He called it his public opinion baths. He said, I need to take them. he said, the people don't get much of me, and this is one thing I can give them. And it gave him a special sense of connection to the public that I think very few of his predecessors had ever had.
Mm-hmm.
And he built on that. He built on it in many ways. He built on it not only through these personal open door policy, but through his public speeches, through his writings, his public writings during the war, in which he forged a bond with the American public that helped him greatly in terms of pursuing his objectives.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I would answer the question. You know, it was a different time. There were not very big staffs in those days. Lincoln did his entire work with the help of just two private secretaries, and basically wrote everything himself. Huge amount of labor, and very little protection. One guard. Later on, they put a second guard outside his bedroom because the death threats were coming in so fast. But much more accessibility than
much
we
more.
Are accustomed to in this day. And I think his assassination is in part what began to change that. And then following that, the assassination of James Garfield and McKinley.
Right.
These three led to a much more strict enforcement of presidential security. And of course, in our own, closer to our own time, John F. Kennedy's assassination led to a complete change in this regard.
Mm-hmm. And what about the picture, the top hat?
The hat.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's referring to the cover art, the
right.
hat.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful picture. That's the actual hat that Lincoln wore to Ford's Theater on the last night of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And it was left there in the box. Picked up, and it was owned by a variety of individuals. It went on display early on in the patent office. It was on loan by various owners, and eventually today it resides in the Smithsonian Institution.
Hmm.
And this is their picture. We obtained it from them, but it is our jacket designer. Just of all the pictures we showed him, thought that this one was unique, and it does kind of make the book pop out at you.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. It's good. Let's spend just a few minutes before we go back to phones on Robert Lincoln and
yeah.
the significance of Robert, who people have said was fairly aloof and not terribly close to his father, but the only character to span the entire book, as you say, who spent his life as the self-appointed guardian of his father's memory.
Well, Robert, and indeed, the book closes with Robert's funeral. So he really is the bookends in a way. He was there the night he had been invited by his father to attend Ford's Theater with them that night. He was home. He remember he had he was very proud to have been taken in, enlisted into the Army, and he had been under Grant's authority. He had actually been at Appomattox courthouse when the surrender had taken place. He was back in Washington visiting his parents. He was living in the White House, and he was upstairs. He wasn't feeling well that night, and he opted to stay home with his friend John Hay, who was Lincoln's private secretary, and they would play a game of cards, and then he would go to bed early.
Mm-hmm.
But for the rest of his life, he berated himself for having made that decision. What might he have been able to do if he could have been along with them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe he could have prevented this from happening. Maybe he could have been taken the blow and in place of his father. You know, maybe some other outcome could have come. But he quickly was thrust into the role of head of family. His mother was absolutely destroyed by what she had seen and what she had experienced. You know, her beloved husband shot in the head, sitting mm-hmm. right next to her as they were holding hands, looking
mm-hmm.
at the play.
Mm-hmm.
She was a very high-strung woman who, nervous and emotional by nature, and she had already suffered the death of her son, Willie, 3 years earlier, and that had thrown her into a very severe depression. This act threw her into a terrible state, and Robert was forced to take over, and he took over all his mother's correspondence. He took over all the family planning for the funeral. And he had to grow up very quickly.
He sure did.
One of the things that happened, which is kind of amazing that I discovered, was that during those frantic days after the assassination, the White House was really not well guarded. And Mary was upstairs in her bedroom, wouldn't come out. And looters came in. People came into the White House and began to take things. There were, you know, souvenir hunters and looters who were just literally walking away with whatever they could grab.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the fear that Robert had was that they would steal his father's papers, which were scattered about the house in various places, mostly upstairs. But his entire body of presidential papers, Robert had boxed up and sent to Illinois to be safeguarded there by his friend and his father's friend, Judge Davis. And from then on, he saw himself, as you say, as the kind of guardian of his father's legacy and memory. Mm-hmm. And he would take charge of those papers, and he would make sure nobody got to see them and without his permission. And in fact, he only gave one biographer the right to use them in his entire life.
Isn't that something?
He did all kinds of things to control how people saw and remembered his father. And some of them were, I think, a little over the top, you know, really.
Right. And they moved. I never knew that the three of them, Ted and Robert and Mary, moved to this hotel in Hyde Park.
Yes.
And is that hotel still there?
I don't think so. Huh. And, well, of course, the city burned. Later.
Right.
And the new city, Chicago, that replaced it is quite a different city.
Uh-huh.
So, interestingly, the house that Robert later owned and lived in survived the fire. But I don't believe that hotel would be still there.
Huh.
That's a good question. I'll look into it. But they lived together not very happily. One of Mary's problems was that, you know, she never felt she had enough money, and the government decided to only pay. They didn't pay out to her the remainder of her husband's salary. She couldn't return to her home in Springfield, which she still owned, but because of the memories there. But she was put on a very pittance of an allowance, and she had to live in hotels and then in boarding houses.
Hmm.
And she hated it. She wanted a house of her own where she could just hide away.
Mm-hmm.
And she couldn't get it. She couldn't get permission to do that. And Robert really was trying to control her own spending habits, and he became quite disgusted with her. And there's a whole story of their relationship, which we chronicle in this book.
Right. More phone calls in a moment. We're speaking with one of the authors of Looking for Lincoln, The Making of an American Icon. Philip Kuhnhart is joining us in this book, the basis of a PBS special, which will be aired in February, companion to this volume. And our guest is part of this long history. Five successive generations of his family helped chronicle the pictures and the research that went into this book, and they've done other books as well. So we're having a good time. A couple lines are open if you want to join us. 800-486-8655 is our number, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls now for Philip, and we go to Eugene from Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning. This is the Wisconsin connection again. There was a black and a Cherokee community, Cheyenne Valley, above Lafarge, Wisconsin. There were five Rebels brothers. One fought for Ohio, and he moved up here after the war, but there were four Rebels brothers that fought for the Union Army. One was in the company to capture Jefferson Davis, and one was a guard for Lincoln at the White House. And you can get copies of their service records from the History Museum in Madison, where they were at and what they did. They were all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
But one was, like I said, one was a guard for... Then there was an arms family. And Otis died in 1980, and his father had been a drummer boy. And they were black.
Mm. Well, did you say the first family was Rebels?
Rebels. R-E-V-E-L-E-S.
Yeah, well, there was a famous black... Congressman named Hiram Rebels. Is that related?
I think so.
Yeah.
I'm just guessing this now. I think so, yes. There's a
Hiram Rebels.
If you're coming out of Hillsboro, Wisconsin,
yeah.
On 33, go to Wildcat Mountain State Park. There's a black cemetery there where one or two of the Rebels brothers are buried there.
Hmm.
That's so interesting. I didn't realize. I've never really done much research into the life of Hiram Rebels and his family. I don't know whether it's the same family at all, but I would like to look into that.
Well, you better tell us about the family that you're thinking about, because we're curious now. Philip?
How do you know about them?
My grandmother married into that black and Cherokee community in the early 1920s. It was a second marriage both of them. My grandmother in the 1890s they were living in Madison at that time, and Mansfield Bass had gone to Madison to look for work, and he went to work for my great-grandfather down there.
Hmm.
And the families, they went their separate directions. My great-grandfather and the family went back to Chicago, and Mansfield went back to farming. Well, in 1918, my grandfather got killed in an automobile accident. And they had a summer home up at Tomahawk, Wisconsin. And the family went up there, and who should my grandmother run into but Mansfield Bass? And they got married and stayed that way. He was Cherokee. And they got married and stayed that way until he died in 1945.
Great.
Rich family history. Eugene,
it's really good, and you really know the history. That's, I commend you to be so knowledgeable about it.
Yeah, it's great. Thanks, Eugene, very much for the call. We go to Larry.
I don't know if there's any connection with rebels from Mississippi. Hiram Rebels was the first black senator. He was elected from Mississippi, which was... I believe he was elected about the same time that Blanche Bruce was also elected. So it may or may not have any connection to the Wisconsin rebels. I'd like to know.
Yeah. Let's go to Larry from Pembine. Hi, Larry.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Just a comment that I have and a question. It was in a discussion I had with a good friend of mine, and it was revolved around the fact that the amount of countries during that time period, during the Civil War, that were also engaged in slavery, and they were able to abolish their slavery without going to war. And the fact that the United States, or it came to that, where they couldn't agree upon that issue, is that the main reason why we had that lasting animosity, which still exists today between the two races?
Well, I because of the war, I don't quite understand your question.
Well, my question was: England abolished slavery without having a civil war.
From my understanding,
the main reason why we went to war with the South was over that particular states' rights issue and the idea of safe slavery.
I think that for a long time there was a school of what they called revisionist historians who were quite critical of Lincoln and his administration for not pursuing more peaceful methods for resolving the conflict. But it's now pretty much consensus that that the South was not going to give up this institution without fighting. Yes, England was a very different environment. When Frederick Douglass traveled over there in 1845, he found a very different society where blacks were welcomed as equals, and this opened his eyes to possibilities. But this country was very slow to follow in that suit. It was more racially prejudiced, and the deep roots of our institution of slavery had corrupted the society. It was the great contradiction in the American experiment in liberty. It was, and according to Douglass and also to Lincoln, it's supposed to be this way. It had been a temporary kind of compromise to get the Constitution passed and get the country off the ground, but that it had set its roots ever deeper. And it was really undermining our reputation in the world and undermining our national character. I do think Lincoln tried to solve the problem without war. He desperately wanted a peaceful resolution of this, and he was even willing to be to compromise on slavery and to allow it to gradually disappear, as it did in the northern states, by the way. I mean, all the slavery existed in New York and other states as well, and it was ended peacefully through gradualism, through laws that gradually had it end. And this might have been the way it was solved here, but Southern radicals did not want to go that route, and in fact, they are the ones who precipitated the war. That's about all I have to say about that, I guess.
It is a lot. I've often been struck and thought a lot, actually, about the months, and we interviewed the author of the book that looked just at the transition period, when he was elected to when he became president, and all that happened, all the states who said, sorry, we're leaving you, before he even becomes president, and thinking, oh my gosh, what a way to walk into this office.
That's right. Well, it started basically right after his election. South Carolina was the first to secede, and that was very shortly after he was elected. I think the news of his election was greeted with great pessimism in the South. He had a reputation of being, because of his House divided speech and his his speeches against Stephen A. Douglas, even though he was a moderate, he had a reputation of being what they called a black abolitionist. He was in favor of black freedom. And there's a feeling that we can't go forward now under this kind of an administration. But he right, and they were still seceding as he journeyed to Washington. I mean, halfway to Washington came the news that that Jefferson Davis had been elected president of a new nation, the Confederate States of America. That was so. This originally the South seceded one by one, but then they got together and formed a new confederation of states, which was which would be true secession.
Yeah. Thanks, Larry, for the call. Jennifer is next from Manitowoc. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for your show.
Sure.
A while back, somebody called in about the governor who had tried to bring medical supplies to Civil War soldiers. That was Lewis P. Harvey, and his wife was Cordelia. Back in November, I went to the Civil War Museum in Kenosha, and there was an actress there who played her and told the story. And so it was Harvey, Lewis P. Harvey, that was the governor.
How is that museum? I haven't been there yet.
Oh, you have to go. It's wonderful.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
It's down the road from you.
Yeah, it is. All right.
All right. And I also share Lincoln's birthday, so he's a special man to me.
Oh, you do. That's wonderful.
So you're gonna have a big party on February 12th.
Yeah. Well, my parents used to always tease me as a child. Is it your birthday? Are you sure? You know, that kind of thing all the time. So
I think you should go to Springfield, don't you?
Oh, I was there when I was five. I'd like to take my daughter there, though.
Yes, that'd
maybe
be great.
We'll do that this summer with the, you know,
I'm going to be there this coming weekend, and I'm going to be there again the weekend after. So I'm going to Springfield twice coming up.
Oh, what are you going to do?
Well, I'm going to speak there at an event having to do with the premiere of our of the PBS special that's associated with this book.
Great.
And then I'm going back again to give another talk about collecting Lincolniana and also to receive an award. There's a bunch of us that have been chosen to receive the Lincoln, the Order of Lincoln Award for our work on the study of Abraham Lincoln, and I'm going out there for that purpose.
Oh, there's an award you'll treasure forever, huh?
Yes.
Oh, that's...
And people coming from all corners to participate in that. So that's going to be a grand event.
Oh, it sure will, Philip. Congratulations. That's great. I love this quote that's in the intro, your intro here, too, from Dubois, which says a lot about Lincoln. I love him not because he was perfect, but because he was not and yet triumphed.
Yeah.
Isn't that a great quote about this guy?
It is a great quote. And, you know, these guys, Dubois, could see the flaws. I mean, this is not a perfect man, and we've made him into a kind of god, but he was in fact a human being. He was a politician. He had to practice what we call the art of the possible, which is what politics is. It's not the art of the perfect. And he had to pull together coalitions, and he moved in a very interesting way. He used what Professor James Oakes has called conservative methods to reach radical ends. And so he surprised people. He was being criticized from both sides, the left and the right, and he moved through what you might call the radical middle. He kind of slipped through the middle so that without even realizing it, he pulled off things for our country that no one had been able to do before and that I don't think anybody else could have done. I think he was, Frederick Douglass said, somehow in him, both the man and the hour came together for our redemption.
Mm-hmm.
And it was true. It took this kind of a man in this kind of a time to pull off the great strides that were made.
Mm-hmm. And have you ever, it's interesting that all these generations in your family have been working so hard on Lincoln scholarship. Did you ever think, maybe I won't do this? I just find it astounding that all your generations have done this.
Well, let me
to the
tell
body
you
of knowledge.
How it went. My great-grandfather, as I said, became this photographic expert and a collector of renown. His daughter, Dorothy Meserve Coonhart, became his assistant and took a huge intellectual interest in the collection and became an author in her own right and Lincoln scholar. And she was in many ways, a more intellectual figure than her father, and so made some very important contributions.
Hmm.
And then later, her son, my dad, and she collaborated on several books together and continued the tradition. My father was the managing editor of Life magazine, which is, so he brought a tremendous interest in pictorial history telling.
Right.
And she brought this great depth of scholarship, and the two of them found they could collaborate in really interesting ways together, and they loved working together.
Hmm.
And so I grew up in this family, and
we have about 10 seconds.
And I knew the old man. He lived till 1962, so I knew him as a boy. And I knew my grandmother very well, and my dad and I became partners back in 1991, and we worked together very, very closely, and I brought my own interest in scholarship to the field. And
there we are, and we have to go. Thank you, Philip, so much for being with us and for the book. It's just a beauty. Looking for Lincoln, the Making of an American Icon. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this show, Rob Schroeder on-air production. Until tomorrow.